Thank you. And let me, I was requested to make this an introduction to deep learning, a more tutorial style introduction to deep learning, because I was made aware that I think the audience is fairly diverse across various centers in India. So this talk will be a tutorial style talk, an introduction to deep learning. I do understand that many of you may already know some of this, but towards the later half of this talk, I'll also talk about recent trends and some of the research that we are doing in deep learning. So hopefully there'll be something to take away for each of you who's attending this talk today. Thank you again for making the time to attend this talk. So as I was just introduced, at IIT Hyderabad, we have in fact a department of AI, which I currently coordinate. We do offer a BTech in AI, MTech in AI, PhD in AI. So we'll be happy to have collaborations at any point with any of your offices around the country. I'm quite sure all of us have heard about the deep learning revolution. It's changed how AI is practiced and deployed in real-world applications today. And it has had an explosive growth, especially over the last decade. Today, for most applications that deal with images, that deal with text, or that deal with speech, it's deep learning that's deployed in practice. We probably use it in our own devices with or without our knowledge. So in terms of publications, in terms of how machine learning models are used in various companies, there has been an exponential growth over the last few years in how deep learning is used and deployed. So if you had to look at a history of deep learning by itself is not a very new topic. I'm very sure for those of you who probably have had an academic background in the 80s, 90s, you probably studied neural networks, deep learning, so on and so forth. It has a history going back to the origins of computing itself. It started with the early 1940s when McCulloch and Pitt started studying how a neuron in the human brain should be computationally modeled. Then in the late 1950s came a person called Rosenblatt who modeled the first neural network at that time called the perceptron. In the early 1960s, people improved upon how do you learn that perceptron using data. However, in the late 1960s and 70s, Minsky and Papert, two researchers at MIT, showed that the perceptron could not scale to all kinds of problems. In particular, they came up with the example of what is popularly known as the XOR problem today, which is the XOR logic gate. And they show that a XOR logic gate cannot be classified by a perceptron, which is called a linear classifier. So while there was a golden age in the early 60s, the 70s to early 80s was a dark age for neural networks and not much work progressed. And that age was a golden age for what is known as symbolic AI or logic-based AI. Somewhere around the mid-1980s, Rumelhart, Hinton, and Williams, Hinton is the one that won the Turing Award for deep learning last year, they came up with this method known as backpropagation. And that's the method that changed how neural networks were trained until that point. Since then, once again, neural networks took a re-emergence, and late 80s to about mid-90s to late 90s, neural networks were extensively used for many different applications. However, around the mid-90s, other kinds of machine learning methods, like support vector machines, boosting methods, so on and so forth, started also becoming popular along with neural networks to the point that they started becoming more popular than neural networks. Somewhere around the mid-2000s, Hinton again, the same person who came up with backpropagation in the late 80s, developed a method known as hierarchical feature learning that helped train very deep neural networks. And that again led to a re-emergence of deep learning. And in 2012 was actually the turning point when an architecture, deep neural network architecture, known as AlexNet, won a challenge known as the ImageNet challenge, which is a popular challenge. We'll talk about that later. And since 2012, there has been no looking back. It's almost been deep neural network models across the board for various machine learning applications. So I'll try to spend the first 15, 20 minutes perhaps on giving a basic introduction to deep learning for those of you who are probably not aware of the space, and then probably talk a little bit more about recent trends and what we have been doing here. So to demystify some terms here, what is machine learning? What is deep learning? What is AI? These days, all of these terms are interchangeably used, but technically speaking, they're not the same thing. AI was always a sub-branch of computer science. I think things are changing now. I think AI is slowly becoming, leaking into other fields and becoming a horizontal under everything in every technology in practice today. But historically speaking, technically speaking, AI was a sub-branch of computer science. And within AI is a sub-branch called machine learning, which refers to one kind of doing AI. There are many other aspects of AI, such as reverse engineering the brain, knowledge representation and learning, planning, so on, and constraint satisfaction, so on and so forth. Machine learning forms one set of tasks in AI. And deep learning is one further sub-area of machine learning that is today understood as representation learning. Why is that important? Any data that you give to a machine learning model, you need to ensure that you give the right representation of your data so that your machine learning model can learn well. And earlier, that used to be done in a handcrafted way, which means if you have image data, text data, speech data, whatever kind of data, you'll have to pre-process it in some way. I think I just heard about, the last few minutes of the previous speaker who was talking about the fact that the pre-processing and annotation can take 70 to 80% of your time, which is actually true. So you have to do a lot of pre-processing before you give data as input to your machine learning model. To some extent, deep learning has taken away that burden and says that if you give raw data to it, it will learn the representation that it needs to solve a particular task. I think we all know now that machine learning is broadly about building models that are good and useful approximations to data. It is about making predictions or decisions from data. It is about learning general models from a data set of particular examples. But more broadly speaking, machine learning is about our journey from data to wisdom. As humans, we are very good at taking data, processing it to information, going from information to knowledge, and then knowledge to wisdom. In fact, as humans, we are very good at explaining ourselves in the top part of this pyramid while we actually don't know how we process the data. So if you ask me why I recognize somebody from a picture, I don't think I can give an answer and say because this pixel is at 10,10 is gray and because this pixel at 20,10 is orange, I really cannot give that kind of an explanation. I really don't know how I process the data within me, but I very much know how I reason things at a higher level of this pyramid. And neural networks have made a revolution in this bottom layer of a pyramid where it takes data and takes it to information and knowledge. Wisdom is still difficult for deep neural networks. And I think that's where probably you need to have humans in the loop while making decisions rather than completely give away something to a deep neural network. Once again, I'm probably sure that you're all aware that machine learning is broadly divided into supervised learning, where you have data and labels, not just data. Examples of such settings is classification and regression. Then you have unsupervised learning, where you have only data given to you. You don't have any annotations, any labels, any meta information about the data. What can you do with it? You can cluster your data. You can reduce the dimension of your data. These kinds of methods are known as unsupervised learning. There are also other settings such as reinforcement learning, semi-supervised learning, structured prediction, so on and so forth. Now, before we go forward, as I said, I'll give a quick introduction to how deep learning methods learn. There is, in fact, just one unified paradigm which has branched out in various kinds over the last decade. One could look at machine learning in terms of a grid. Along one axis, you have supervised learning and unsupervised learning. The other axis, you have discrete data or continuous data or discrete labels and continuous labels. So in classification is a supervised learning technique where your label space is discrete. So you're trying to take a data point and say this is anomalous or not anomalous, or you're trying to take a data point and say this is Mr. A or Mrs. B. So that's what you're trying to do in classification. Regression is again a supervised learning paradigm where your output space is continuous. You're not predicting a category, you're predicting a real value. You could be predicting the temperature in today's weather, you could be predicting somebody's age, you could be predicting a stock price. All of those fall under regression. Clustering is an unsupervised learning technique where your output space is discrete. You're probably dividing data into a set of different groups. You don't know what each of those groups mean, but those groups are discrete with respect to each other. And then finally, you have dimensionality reduction methods, where given data that could be very high dimensional, example image data, remember a single 1 megapixel image, which is not even considered high resolution today, is 1 million pixels, which means the dimension of the data is 1 million. If you take color, it becomes 3 million. But that's the kind of space on which you have to do your computations, which becomes pretty difficult. So how do you reduce the dimensionality of your data and make it more easy for machine learning algorithms to work with is what dimensionality reduction methods are. This is a simple categorization of different machine learning methods. So let me try to take a few methods and talk about how they work intuitively. I'm not going to go into the math here. Let's just talk about the intuition of how they work, and then I'll come to how neural networks or deep learning actually works. The simplest classification methods that people use in practice is, and the basic intuition of k-nearest neighbors is that you have a lot of data points that are already labeled for you. It's the supervised setting. So if a new data point enters your system, you look at its nearest neighbor in terms of a Euclidean distance or any other distance for that matter. And whatever was the class label data point. Now, you could simply not just look at the nearest neighbor alone. You could look at the 3 nearest neighbors or the 5 nearest neighbors or the 7 nearest neighbors and average out the decisions that you get from all of them. That's one of the simplest classifications that you can do. It does work well in practice if you have good representations of your data. Another popular example, as I said, which is even used today, was used extensively at least a decade ago, is support vector machines. Support vector machines have a different premise to how they go about formulating the problem. Given data points from 2 different classes, you could assume that all these data points belong to some data that is anomalous, and all these data points belong to some data that is normal. So your job is to find out, how do I draw this line that separates the anomalous points and the normal points? It need not be a line. It could be a hyperplane in some higher dimension. So you could ideally draw that line, something like that. But is that the only line that you can draw that separates these 2 classes? Not really. You could probably come up with infinite possible lines that can separate these 2 classes. Now, the question that support vector machine asks is, which of these lines is the best line? And it happens that you could analyze this in terms of between a point and the class given one particular choice of the line. Here on this slide, that given this choice, the margin is given by this. If you're choosing differently, the red band changes. So what kind of a margin that you need in practice? A maximum margin. Why do you need a maximum margin? Because that will give you the least of error. If the margin, that means the margin of error is also, you don't want to have such kind of a model to be deployed in practice. So that's the main idea of SVM. And based on trying to maximize this margin, the formulation casts this as an optimization problem, and then you solve the dual of the optimization problem using quadratic programming, and then you finally get your solution. That's the way support vector machines work. Similarly, you have other machine learning models such as decision trees, where given a set of data points, you come up with a set of conditions or rules as different nodes in a tree, and then you just evaluate each condition, go down the tree, and finally make your decision. This can work when you have a limited number of attributes or features in your data, because you can then analyze every feature and then go down a tree of decisions and arrive at a leaf, which finally gives you your final answer. But when you have a million dimensions in your data, such as images or gene data or any other data for that matter, then how do you build a decision tree becomes a little difficult. That brings us to deep learning, which is considered a rebirth of neural networks. It's called neural networks because it's broadly inspired by the human brain. It doesn't imitate the human brain. It's only inspired by the human brain. And the simple architecture that everybody commonly uses is, you have an input layer where your input data comes in. Each neuron corresponds to one input dimension of your data. And then you have an output layer, which is your decision layer, that corresponds to the number of classes that you want to output or the number of values that you want to output. That's what you have in the output layer. So all your intermediate layers are known as hidden layers, which are looking at trying to process the data in a form in which you get a representation in the penultimate layer, which helps the classification in the final layer. That's the overall structure of these neural networks. Now, how do they learn? So that's the main crux of how they work. So let's take a very simplistic example and see how they learn. There's no math here. I'm just going to show it using images because of the diverse audience that may be here. I'll keep it very simple. So let's take one of these neurons. So let's imagine three inputs, minus 0.06, minus 2.5, and 1.4. And we assume that every connection in this neural network that you see here, every connection, let's assume, has some weights on all of those connections. And that's the main thing that you have to learn when you train a neural network. So if you had to assume some weights in your neural network, then you'll get a dot product between your weights and your inputs, and you'll get a certain output. Now let's take a slightly more complex setting where there are three inputs, one hidden layer with three neurons, and then finally an output. And let's assume that you have a data set where the first row corresponds to three attributes and values corresponding to three attributes, and you have a class label that says 0 or 1. And based on the error, when the next data point is presented, you again adjust your weights, and then you repeat this thousands and probably millions of times using an optimization method known as gradient descent. Gradient descent is a method that you use to minimize any objective function. In our case, we minimize the error function that you have that is looking at the difference between your predicted output and expected output. So, and there's a lot of technicality behind this, but that's the simple idea of how deep neural networks learn. Now, and this procedure was what was developed in 1986 as backpropagation. And this is the procedure that is used to this day, 35 years hence. It's still the same procedure that is used in all deep learning models that are deployed around the world today. What has changed is what are the different architectures in the way in which you can arrange your neurons. So if you have your inputs as images, you do what are known as convolutional neural networks, where given an image, instead of simply connecting that image to all neurons in subsequent layers, you arrange them in such a way that you can perform a convolution, which is a signal processing operation, between the input image and the next layer, and so on and so forth. So instead of simply doing a dot product between the weights and the input, you now do a convolution between your weights and the input, and the rest of it stays very similar to a neural network. Once again, you learn the weights of the convolutional neural network using the method known as backpropagation and gradient descent. So as I was mentioning, the turning point of deep learning in over the last decade was in 2012 in a challenge known as the ImageNet challenge. The ImageNet is a challenge that was developed to be able to benchmark the performances of machine learning models across the world. It started in 2010, just a decade ago. And a lot of machine learning models were applied and participated and got a certain error in this particular challenge. However, in 2012, there was this architecture known as AlexNet, developed by Alex Krizhevsky and Jeffrey Hinton again. And they significantly brought down the error from previous years. The previous year had an error rate of about 25% on this ImageNet challenge. And AlexNet brought down the error to 15%, which was a significant improvement at that time. And that made people take notice of deep learning in 2012. And since then, every year, the winner of the ImageNet challenge has been a deep neural network. In fact, I personally know faculty who have explicitly taken up the challenge to use machine learning models to somehow beat this trend. And they've just not been able to beat this trend at all, and simply not been able to beat the performance of deep learning. So AlexNet was followed by something called Overfit, XylerNet, VGG, GoogleNet, Residual Networks, which was by Microsoft Research. And somewhere around 2015-16, these models started outperforming humans on this task of image classification. And since then, I think it's exploded in the various kinds of applications that it has been used. So these are some sample results on ImageNet. So this is, of course, these are old results. This is 8 years old, which is prehistoric considering how things have been going forward. But nevertheless, for completeness, so these are the kinds of images on which AlexNet gave a strong performance. And if you take an image such as the leopard here, even I wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the leopard, jaguar, cheetah, snow leopard, Egyptian cat, so on and so forth. But the model actually gave the highest confidence to leopard, which was the correct answer. So these kinds of images are hard to classify even for humans, and deep learning models do excellently well on these kinds of applications. Similarly, if you'd like to use deep learning for time series kind of data, it need not be just time series. It could be a video. It could be a document. A document is also considered as a sequence of words. So in all of these kinds of settings, you use what are known as recurrent neural networks or LSTMs, long short-term memories, for being able to process them. Once again, even here, it's the architecture that has changed. The learning still happens using the methodology known as backpropagation and gradient descent. There are also what are known as autoencoders for doing unsupervised dimensionality reduction. And that brings us to this question as to what really changed. Why did things start working suddenly when deep learning came into the picture? And today it's understood that this is broadly because deep learning learns representations of data that become useful for machine learning algorithms to act later. In a sense, this is similar to the human brain, because the human visual cortex, for instance, has several layers of processing before we finally realize what is happening around the scene in the final visual cortex. Before that, you have the V1, V2, V3, so on and so forth, all of which does different layers of processing. But if one had to ask why was neural networks not successful, backpropagation was invented in the 1980s, it's broadly because today you have higher computational power to crunch these numbers, and today you have higher data power that can feed into these neural networks to learn effectively. So the world around us is compositional. So if you take images, it goes from pixel to edges to textons to motifs to parts of an object to objects to scenes and so on and so forth. If you take documents, we go from character to words to phrases to sentences to stories. So this hierarchical processing of data through layers in a neural network is essential for its success. And that's one of the reasons why neural networks are better fit for these kinds of data that are inherently hierarchical also. This is just an example which shows that the earlier layers of the neural network process edges and different low-level image features. The mid layers of the neural network learn certain abstractions. In this case, the inputs were face images. So in this case, they learn things like eyes, nose, so on and so forth. And finally, you have abstractions such as the full face images in later layers. Now let's come to, that probably concludes my early section, and now I'll talk about the recent trends and some of the things that we're doing. Let me just take a time check here. I know we started at 12:45. Would it be okay to go for 10 to 12 more minutes? Or if you had a hard stop for me, please let me know.
It would be completely fine, sir.
Okay, I'll try to go for 10 to 12 more minutes and then I'll be happy to take questions. So now what has happened since 2012. So let's try to talk about that. And so I try to convey in a nutshell the various things that are going on around in a few slides. The first thing, the revolution of AlexNet.
Dr. Vineet, are you there with us, sir? I would like to inform that Dr. Vineet has logged out for a while because of certain bandwidth issues, and he'll be joining us shortly.
Can you see me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you now, sir. Request to share your presentation again, sir. I have already made you a presenter, sir.
Sure. About that, I've switched my Wi-Fi connection again. I have two Wi-Fi connections. Both seem strong, but I've switched it. Hopefully, this won't happen for the rest of the session. Can you hear me all right now?
Yes, sir, I'm able to see your slides. Wonderful. So please, you may continue, sir.
Sure, thank you. So I'm not sure where I got dropped off, but I was talking about the recent trend being having neural networks which are deeper and deeper. So I was just mentioning that over the last few years, the networks have got deeper and deeper. And somewhere around when you go to a depth of about 100 to 150 layers, your performance starts saturating, and after that, adding layers doesn't really add value. This has also been done with recurrent neural networks that handle time series data. In fact, the Google Translate that you may have used, in fact, uses a stacked LSTM model. LSTM, as I mentioned, stands for long short-term memories that's used for time series understanding. People have also started hybridizing architectures. What happens if you combine a convolutional neural network and a recurrent neural network? You can start solving problems at the intersection of images and text, or images and time series data. So you could take an image and now caption the image automatically. You could take this image and say a boy is playing a ball. Or you could take a movie and be able to give an automatic caption for that entire movie using these kinds of hybrid architectures. But an important thing to keep in mind is, while machine learning and neural networks is a science, it has very strong mathematical foundations, making it work is an engineering task. There are lots of little pieces, lots of little hyperparameters, including regularization, initialization of weights, choosing the parameters of gradient descent, choosing what are known as activation functions in each layer, choosing your loss function at the end. All of them are some things that tuned to make these approaches work for a given application. Another dimension of deep learning that has been extremely successful over the last few years is known as deep reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning, as I mentioned initially, is one setting of machine learning which is not classification, which is not regression. It is typically used in gaming applications or any agent-based systems where you do not have an immediate reward. So if you make a decision on a given data point, you do not get a label or you do not get a prediction, but you have a sequence of steps to get a finally delayed reward. Example, playing chess, playing this game called Go, or playing any game for that matter, where a series of moves finally decides what is the outcome. And that's where deep reinforcement learning also comes into play. I think most of you may have heard of AlphaGo and AlphaZero, which were Google DeepMind's deep learning models that beat the best players in the world on Go and chess. In fact, as we speak, both these models have retired because they have not been able to beat, no human has been able to beat them at this particular time. And the more interesting thing is AlphaZero, which is a deep learning model that played chess, trained itself in just 4 hours of playing itself. So no games, no previous moves given to it. It completely trained itself by playing itself. No previous games or any moves shared with it. And of course, due to this, we have seen a proliferation of applications in vision, speech, text in various different domains. And we've also seen a proliferation in the programming frameworks that are used behind the scenes. Today, some of the best programming frameworks, if you'd like to use deep learning, is TensorFlow, which Google maintains and luckily keeps it open source, or PyTorch, which Facebook maintains and luckily keeps it open source. There is also Amazon's MXNet, Microsoft's CNTK, so on and so forth. And there are a bunch of different frameworks that you can use, readily use, to build your applications if you don't want to go into the nitty-gritties. So these frameworks take care of how these things are implemented and how they actually interact with the hardware, and you can directly start your programming at a far higher level. You also have an entire ecosystem of deep learning startups that have revolutionized various industries over the last few years. So what are the new frontiers that people have been looking at in this domain over the last few years? Let's look at them. And I think I did hear a conversation in the earlier talk about GANs. And this is a new frontier at this time. Deep generative models, GANs, generative adversarial networks, or variational autoencoders, which are known as VAEs. These are models that help generate data. Many applications in the real world suffer from very limited data. So can you automatically generate data using these kinds of approaches has been a very important trend in the last 4 to 5 years. On one hand, it helps in generating more data. On the other hand, it also helps in artistic pursuits. It can be in, you can generate a movie today. In fact, there is a company that can automatically compose music at this time. So you can have an automatic ARM on today, which, given a movie, can automatically compose music for that movie. There's already a company that exists that does this in practice today. So these are known as deep generative models. Then you also, an important trend is also the concept of what is known as transfer learning. So one question you could ask is, if I've now trained a machine learning model or a deep learning model on a lot of data, tomorrow I may have a new task in a different place. So I've trained some model that works in Bombay. Can I make this model work in Hyderabad? So this idea, so now to take a model that works in Bombay and then transfers it to make it work in Hyderabad is known as transfer learning. As deep learning gets used in more and more settings, more and more newer things, it's important to be able to study these kinds of contexts where you can quickly transfer knowledge from one task to another task. So within this, there are keywords such as zero-shot learning, one-shot learning, few-shot learning, self-supervised learning, so on and so forth. And this is actually a very active area of our research at IIT Hyderabad. Another aspect that has been revolutionizing deep learning in the last few years is the concept of attention and memory. So when you take an image and you classify the image, can you attend to different parts of the image to be able to make your final decisions? As humans, given an image, we of course look at the full image, but we also are capable of attending to different parts of the image to make our final decisions. How do you incorporate this when you use neural networks to solve problems is another angle that has been extremely active. In fact, for those of you a little bit more savvy, transformer networks, which came 2 years ago, are essentially attention models in practice, And today, transformer models are considered the de facto approach for machine translation and NLP tasks. So entire space of attending to different parts of the input to solve your problems is a very important paradigm today, which is revolutionizing things, especially in the last couple of years. Another aspect that's also being studied by researchers around the world today is, what is the theory behind all of this? In fact, one of the biggest challenges of using neural networks is that of the people don't understand why they work. So you throw data at it, it seems to learn some representations and it works. Why does it work? Unfortunately, is still not understood. To some extent, even the human brain is not understood in completeness, and the same thing reflects here too. A very important thing, maybe especially important for organizations such as the Navy, is efficient deep learning. So if you want to be able to deploy deep learning in a remote corner of the world, in a remote ocean, then you need to be able to deploy it on small sensors that may not have enough power, that may not have enough memory. But unfortunately, some of these architectures, such as AlexNet, VGGNet, so on and so forth, are about 200 MB plus or 500 MB plus just to store the model, not forget anything else, just to store the model. And this may not work if your memory is very limited or even power is very limited. How do you scale deep learning to edge devices? There are models today. This is also something that we work on at IIT Hyderabad. And there have been excellent models today that have been deployed that can give you 50 to 100x compression in terms of storage without losing any performance in terms of accuracy. This is another trend that people have been working on. Other emerging directions are deep learning on graphs, geometric deep learning meets physics, so on and so forth. Let me just take a couple of more minutes to talk about what are the limitations. Where does deep learning lack? Which I think, once again, is important for organizations such as defense and the Navy. And I'll then conclude, and I'll be happy to take more questions. A key problem with deep learning is that we really don't know why and how they work. Interpretability and explainability are extremely important, and they lack today in deep learning models. So the way deep learning models work, as we just explained as an abstraction, is you give an input to the deep learning model and you get an output, and it goes through several layers of processing. What is each layer doing? How is it processing the data? We really don't have that information. So there are efforts. In fact, this is one specialty of our research at IIT Hyderabad here. Explainable AI is something that we work a lot on. We've actually developed models that people have used today, including for understanding why COVID is in a particular chest x-ray, so on and so forth. There have been efforts on trying to demystify neural networks and trying to visualize and understand what a neural network is focusing on while it makes a prediction. For example, given an image of a hair, did it look at the hair while calling it a hair, or did it look at the grass behind and call it a hair? If it looked at the grass, tomorrow, if a hair is found in any other location, it's not going to work. So how do you build that trust that a deep learning model is looking at the right object while making the prediction is an extremely important aspect of deep learning, which is still being studied and the area is still nascent. Also important, this is also something that we work on at IIT Hyderabad, to do causal inference in deep learning. So deep learning models very broadly model correlations between the data. But correlations may not tell you what caused a particular outcome. What in the data caused a particular outcome is still a very open problem and is still yet to be studied. And we don't have models that can be able to say this. So I'll give an example, say from healthcare. Let's say you have patient records. And let's imagine that tomorrow there is a hospital that deploys a deep learning model as a receptionist. You probably take your patient record and give it to this deep learning model, and it looks at various attributes and say it can give a risk of a heart attack. So it's possible that whenever a person has a heart attack, the blood pressure is elevated. But so obviously that's going to correlate with the outcome, but that does not mean that an elevated blood pressure causes the heart attack. So it's important that a machine learning model needs to know what caused an outcome rather than what correlated with the outcome. Another important aspect, which has again become important over the last few years, is that neural networks are easily fooled. So what you see here is an example where, given an image, you perturb the image with some small noise And originally, while it classified the image as a truck, now this image that you see, which I'm pointing to, the neural network now thinks that it's an ostrich. In fact, not only that, it thinks this animal here is an ostrich. It now thinks also this temple is an ostrich just by adding some noise. And all of these are classified as ostrich with 99% confidence. Now, this is a problem. Why? Because I could now take my image, add some random noise to my image, and show it in front of a CCTV camera, and now just impersonate as somebody else completely. I don't need their image. I don't need their iris. I simply can take my own iris scan, perturb it with a few pixels, and now pose as somebody else. This becomes a huge challenge. And another important thing that also needs to be done is the entire space of machine learning and deep learning currently is data driven. That is data that we make decisions. Shouldn't we also integrate domain knowledge through knowledge graphs to the common sense into decision making? That is another thing where deep learning models and machine learning models currently lack, and is something that needs to be looked at as we go forward today. As I already said, hyperparameters and engineering still remains an open problem, and making a deep learning model work becomes still a challenge. Let me just take 1 minute to talk about some of the efforts that we do at IIT Hyderabad, and then I'll stop there for questions. So we work a lot with learning with limited supervision. How can you make deep learning models work when you have very limited label data is something that we work on. We work on a lot on explainable machine learning, and we've also been working on understanding the theory of deep learning itself. All of these have been our efforts from an algorithmic perspective. And from an applied perspective, we have been looking at human behavior understanding from images, videos, could be gesture recognition, action recognition, emotion recognition, so on and so forth. Of late, we've been looking a lot on doing computer vision on drones. Could be for various different applications, including defense. Some of these are projects from DRDO. And we've also been looking at computer vision for agriculture, as well as we're part of an initiative on autonomous navigation in the Indian context. Most of this work is published in top-tier venues around the world. And from an application perspective, we have been looking at security and surveillance, culture, autonomous navigation, and we also closely collaborate with companies like Honeywell on aerospace applications. I'll be happy to describe some of these in more detail later, but I do know I've probably taken the time that I was allotted. I apologize for the interruptions in between, but hopefully you got an introduction to the fundamentals of deep learning and how it came to be, and also an idea of the various challenges and the various trends that people have been looking at in this limited duration. Thank you for your patient hearing, and once again this invite. I'll be happy to take any questions at this time.
Thank you, sir. You may close the interview, sir. I would like to request audience, if they have any particular question, they may raise their hand or they may type in their questions. Meanwhile, I would like to thank Dr. Vineet for his talk. He actually described the complex topics of deep learning and machine learning in a very lucid manner for the benefit of the audience. Having studied these subjects in details during my post-graduation, I am very well aware that these topics are actually very complicated, and sir had described them in a very fundamental manner. Also, you covered advanced topics like efficient deep learning, attention, and memory in deep learning. So you also touched upon explainable AI, which is one of the sub-themes of our AI webinar. And you talked about correlation and causality, touching upon how explainable deep learning is going to evolve. So I'll now see the questions of the audience. So we have one question from the audience that you mentioned that deep learning can be given raw data. Does that mean the data need not be pre-processed?
Sure.
Could you please amplify that, sir?
Sure. So to a large extent, actually, yes. So the basic, the only thing that people do today to provide input to the deep neural network, such as images, for instance, is maybe you do some illumination normalization. So you have to, of course, normalize your data. That's a very simple pre-processing step that everybody do. But other than that, you can just give the image as input to the deep neural network, and it just works and learns the representations that it should. Just to contrast this, earlier, 10 years ago, or probably even 5 years ago, people used to not just pre-process the data or not just normalize the data, but people also had to find out what kind of features you need, histogram of oriented gradients, binary patterns, SIFT, so on and so forth. All of that is not required. Just some basic normalizations, and then you're good to go and give the data as it is as input to the neural network.
Thank you, sir. Sir, I have one question from my side, sir. At the Center of Excellence for Big Data at INS Valsura, we were undertaking a project early this year about the image classifications. And we faced a problem that the number of images of, it was a ship identification program, and the number of images of the ships were quite less. And that is the reason we could not get the more accuracy in deep learning methods. In such kind of problems, when the data is less, what kind of solutions in deep learning could help us?
Sure. So one thing I should say is, for all problems, deep learning may not be the solution. So I think if it is worthwhile also checking with more traditional machine learning, I think if at all there's a tradition, I would highly recommend methods, probably support vector machines and ensemble methods like boosting and random forests. Those are probably the best methods that you can use from traditional machine learning methods. So it is worth trying, because these kinds of methods don't need the amount of data that deep neural networks need, because deep neural networks have millions of parameters. So they obviously need lots of data to be able to train those parameters. On the other hand, something like support vector machines has only a few parameters. So a little data is sufficient to learn those models. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind, that not always is deep learning the solution. The other aspect is, today there are lots of different approaches to train such models using deep learning and limited supervision. So, I mean, on another day, I would have given a talk completely on that topic. We have a lot of work in that space on learning with limited supervision. But certain keywords there, you have to understand your problem setting and accordingly cast the problem, but I'll try to explain that. So there is a setting called zero-shot learning, where you don't have any labeled images and you can still learn. But this assumes that you have data from certain other classes, and you also have some meta information about the classes. So for example, you could have some textual description about other classes and also about, say, a certain ship that you have. And now, using those relationships between your textual information or the meta information, you can predict the class for which you have limited data using zero-shot learning approaches. Another kind of genre of methods are known as methods that address the long tail problem. So one of the characteristics of any data set, I mean, it may not be just the Navy, it's any data set in the real world, is they all have what is known as the long tail. What is a long tail? It means that if you have, say, 10 classes or 100 classes in your problem, for certain classes, you'll have a lot of data. For certain classes, you'll have very little data. And that's the reality of the world and collection of data itself. So that's known as a long tail. So you have certain data points for which you have a lot of data, and certain classes for which you have a lot of data, and certain classes for which you do not have as much data. So there are a set of methods that try to address the long tail problem. So you need to see if that's where your setting is actually in. Another problem that you could have perhaps in a ship identification setting is the problem of imbalanced data. So it's possible that you have one class, it could be, for example, objects on the sea, right? It could be any other object on the sea, for which you may have a lot of data, and only ship alone, or a particular kind of a ship alone, you may have very little data. So this kind of a setting is known as imbalanced data setting. So there are certain set of deep learning methods, the way you play with your loss functions in deep learning, that can help improve the performance in this kind of a setting. So to summarize, based on, maybe I should also add here that you can also do transfer learning. So if you have another domain where you have a good model, then you transfer that model into a domain where you have limited data. So it depends on what's the exact problem setting you have. So when you say you have very little data of ships, do you have good amount of data on other kinds of objects? Or are there models that have built such, are there other data sets from, say, other countries or publicly available that have built such models that can be adapted to this problem? Those are all decisions or analysis that you have to do of your problem formulation before deciding which way to go. So, but there are solutions would be my short answer.
Thank you, sir, for your guidance on this project. And I'm sure we will explore these new dimensions, and it will help us in our project, sir.
Thank you.
I would like to formally thank you for enlightening the audience with your talk. And as you may be aware, sir, that naval officers would have already commenced their M.Tech in AI at your prestigious institute, IIT Hyderabad, sir, from this year onwards. And we look forward to see naval officers doing their M.Tech from IIT Hyderabad in AI and joining the AI Center of Excellence here and leading the adoption of AI in Indian Navy.
Same here. We are very grateful that you chose IIT Hyderabad, and we are very happy to have your officers as part of IIT Hyderabad. We hope that they have a very good learning experience, and as I said, perhaps may lead to collaborations and us contributing to projects eventually over time too.
Thank you once again, sir, for leaving us with such a much wider technological perspective today. Thank you again, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much again for the opportunity.